Good morning, everyone.
I don't think the irony is lost upon Alex that many years ago, he was a young man with stringy hair on Haight-Ashbury with his big legalized marijuana sign. And now he's in the Hilton with a tie around his neck. And either that's selling out or moving up, but you've made very, very well for yourself, sir. And so, look, I'm going to speak for a little while, and then Alex is going to jump in and interrupt me, and I'll stop, and I'll take a few questions, and then you all will get on with your day. You have a lot of speakers and a lot of stuff. I think it is perfect for me to be speaking to you. It's fun to speak to a bunch of people who enjoy cannabis for whatever reason, but I think it's very relevant to talk to people who will be potentially selling and shaping the consciousness of how the perception of cannabis in the state of California and anywhere else in the world. And so you are the people I really want to talk to the most. I don't use cannabis at all. I'm not one of those people who smacks the joint out of someone's hand. I just don't want it. But one day if I do, I don't want to sneak around. I don't want to have to get a medical card. I just want to go buy it like I want to buy anything else. I don't want to feel bad about doing it. And that's why I am so much for the legalization, and even more importantly to me, the more important than the legalization of cannabis, but the decriminalization of it and to remove the stigma of it. And so here's the thing that happened a few years ago, because that's the most important thing, and I'll get into that in about 20 minutes before I take the Q&A thing. A few years ago, I was doing a television show on the History Channel called 10 Things You Don't Know About, Insert Topic. And our show was very, very good. We had a team of experts, and we did 10 Things You Don't Know About Presidential Assassinations, 10 Things You Don't Know About the Hoover Dam, etc., etc. We only got 2 seasons on History Channel. Why? Because our show was so rich with history. It had no signs of alien abduction, Yeti, the paranormal, or vampires. We were too history-rich for History Channel, so we had to go. But before they dumped our wonderful show, I proposed a show, because we have to, you know, come up to produce these shows. We have these ideas. I said, how about 10 Things You Don't Know About the History of Cannabis and Hemp in America? Because it is steeped in racism, in bigotry, corruption, and just downright meanness. And History Channel said, that's a good idea. So we got to work. And a few years ago, on 420, on April 20th, we were in Denver, Colorado for the High Times Cannabis Cup. We, being History Channel, we get full run of the place. They're expecting about 30,000 people at this event. I have never seen so many bored policemen in my life. As these kids line the parking lot, a line that goes from here to Long Beach. It was incredible. Hacky sacks, frisbees, and all you see is cops chasing hacky sacks and giving frisbees back. Saying, can you please stay on the sidewalk? No heads were cracked open. It was just a bunch of wonderful, peaceful people dressed up in brightly colored outfits. And so we get to have the cool camera angle. We set up our camera inside the doors. So at 9 a.m. or whenever it was, and the doors open, young people come flooding in right by our camera going, yay! And I spent all day there. And we spent part of the day in the vendor part. We talked to young entrepreneurs who were selling everything from product to accoutrement, a place to put your weed. And then we spent the other half of the day in the room where everyone is enjoying the product. And the first part of the day, we were interviewing people who couldn't finish a sentence because they're having a really good time. Then we went into the other part where everyone is enjoying the product, and I became the person who couldn't finish the sentence. And usually I can remember everything I need. I don't need a script, I don't need notes, I don't need nothing. I usually have it right here. Within 20 minutes of being in this cannabis-rich environment, I can't even get to the end of a sentence. And so I'm talking to people, and they're smiling, and I'm smiling, and I don't remember any of the interview. And so, mercifully, lunch intervened. And so we're sitting in some green room area with the sandwiches one of our assistant producers ran out to get to us for us. And I'm sitting there eating this sandwich, and I'm thinking, am I doing I'm High 101? Because I have really no experience with cannabis except for the one time in May of 1987 at 7-Eleven Hamilton Street in Trenton, New Jersey, where I smoked the bass player's joint out of boredom. And I'm not trying to express any contempt for cannabis, not at all, quite the opposite. But I said, let me try that. And they said, Henry, you? I went, yes. And I tried it, and I got incredibly stoned, where I had to be counsel on how to put a glass of water back on a table. I'm like, how do I do that? He said, you just put it down. I was like, can you walk me through this? I went, boom. I said, really? And you guys function on this? And my rhythm section functioned marvelously. And so just so you know, if you ever was a fan of any record I made, most of those were cannabis fueled, in part, just so you know. And that's not that much of a secret. I just want you to know it. Anyway, cannabis cup. And so I'm eating this sandwich, and I don't want to ask this question, but I have to. And I'm eating the sandwich, and it's like every taste bud on my tongue is exploding with pleasure for this tuna melt that I got from some sandwich place. And I looked at my fellow staff, or my, you know, the shoot people, and I said, am I a little bit under the weather? Or is this the best tasting sandwich I've ever had in my life? And they went, I didn't want to say anything, but it tastes really good. And so the thing that hit me, besides meeting all these wonderful young people at this cannabis event, was one day you're not going to need this anymore. That is to say, one day cannabis will be easily obtained and we won't have to have the cannabis cup and people won't have to run in through the door going, yay, I'm kind of free for a little while in this state. They can just say, I go to the store, I get my groceries, I get some cannabis, why I have arthritis, or I just enjoy it for whatever reason. And that is why I am here with you today. Many, many years ago in Washington, D.C., where I was born and raised, I learned about racism by kids running up to me and calling me cracker and Bama and hitting me or putting their fists in my face. And I would dependably piss my pants in front of them. I was very nervous, and it didn't take much to terrify me. And so by third grade, I understood racism because my mom made me understand these kids don't mean what they say. They're just getting bad information from their parents. It's an angry time. Because to the left of my mother is Joan Baez in a wall. She worked for health education and welfare under Joseph Califano, under Johnson. She tried to make public educational delivery systems deliver. I'm sure she's probably wanting to bite the face off Betsy DeVos right now. And so I learned about racism at an early age. And by 1969 or so, I realized that my journey through America was going to be very different being white than it was going to be for my classmates who were not white. They were going to have a very different America. And that was a very intense thing to take on as a 9 or 10-year-old, but I understood it. And going forward, I remember in my 15th year or so, I was on a skateboard with all my friends, and we'd go pick up one of our friends from his house so we could all go run around on the streets like crazy young kids. And his mom had glaucoma, a word I was not familiar with. She had glaucoma. She got legal cannabis from the government, and it would come in a peanut butter jar, a plastic jar of like 50 purple, I'll never forget it, 50 purple rolling paper joints, very, very skinny. And I remember smelling it and knowing what I know now about cannabis, that weed was really bad. And so my friend used to steal the second half of the purple joint from the ashtray so he could enjoy it. And as a young person, I understood something that is relevant to all of us right now. There was hypocrisy and duality in how America prosecuted cannabis possession. If you have glaucoma and you got the right government hookup, the government sends you weed in the mail. But if you're the stoner high on Robin Trower and bad weed outside the arena, you could be in trouble. And as a young person, I started going to parties to hang out and try and meet girls. I was very, very shy. And so I'd get one invite, and I'd go to these houses in my neighborhoods in Washington, D.C. And inside are all the young proto-Reaganites getting drunk, trying to beat each other up or cop a feel. But the real thing was happening outside. The guys who were smoking cannabis, who could not get in because the parents don't want the smell in the house. Alcohol and vomiting on the carpet was fine, but the smell of cannabis, not fine. And I found myself standing outside in inclement weather with the, quote, stoners. Why? They were friendlier, they were smarter, and they were funnier. And so that's when I started to understand that marijuana, the prosecution against it, was a scam. And I don't need to tell you your American history, you're all over it, but just a few quick bullet points. American history is steeped in genocide, brutality, slavery, corruption from the beginning to right now. And one of the things that started the beginning of the 20th century after the Mexican Revolution was marijuana started coming into this country, almost immediately identified as a Mexican person's high, a brown-skinned person's high. When white culture started adopting it, the law and the governments of whatever state started coming down on it. You remember the guy Harry J. Anslinger, 1932, I think the Uniform State Drugs Narcotic Act became relevant and demonizing marijuana all across the country, where it is now still to this day. It resides as a Schedule I controlled substance, right there with LSD and heroin and GHB and ecstasy and marijuana. And basically the definition for a Category 1 substance would be having no redeeming medical value with potential for abuse, which is exactly a 180 from the truth. And so as you've seen all over this country, states are starting to flip, and this is what is relevant to all of us, and this is why I wanted to talk to you today. It is going to be an affront to state governments and big pharma and other huge forces in the economic universe when states start going legal. States have seen Colorado and how much money comes in. They will be unable to resist that money. But please understand, in our wonderful California and anywhere else in America, no doubt they weighed the idea of, will we make more money in tax revenue from regulating marijuana sales, or will we make more money throwing Johnny with his ass pocket of weed into jail for having marijuana? It's not hearts and minds from the government. It's how much money can we make? And they're seeing they can make more money in weed. So these people are not your friend. They would rather bust you than not. They just like your money better than the incarceration buck. And I'm gonna elaborate that on that in a second. One other thing about that cannabis cup thing I went to, I spent several days in Colorado with History Channel filming different aspects of the cannabis industry. We went to a grow facility that was about the size of a Walmart. It was an industrial space like this, you know, very kind of utilitarian, but it went on, you could tee off a golf ball in it and the golf ball wouldn't hit a wall. It was that big. And we did a 3-hour tour of the facility with the scientist who organized the whole thing. Three young men owned this place. They are blood brothers. The three brothers got out of real estate because they saw the end of that dollar, and they wanted a new dollar. So they got into cannabis, and they got into it in a big way. We went to room to room to room. This plant is 4 weeks old. These plants are 5 weeks old. And it's all hydroponically grown and cloned from the plant the guy developed when he was in college. The guy was amazing. The facility was incredible. Every plant was bar tagged. I mean, it is a very intense operation. We were there for hours, and the next day after we were there, we went to the dispensary or the shop where the guys, the brothers' goods are vended. And the cannabis goes in an armored truck to the place because it's worth so much money. And so inside, it was incredible. They have all kinds of strains and all kinds of things you can get. But what was really fascinating to me was the staff. The staff was really well dressed and very sharp young people who had tried every single product inside the store. And I'm sure they had a really good time. We had some jokes about that. But what they were very concerned with is you, the customer, coming in and getting the right product. And so I interviewed one young lady. I said, well, walk me through that. Say I'm a novice cannabis enthusiast, and what would you sell me? She said, well, I'm not going to sell you this, this, or this, because these are very, very psychedelic highs. This is advanced math. We would break you in on the ground floor with this, this, or this. And I did not understand that there's so many different kinds and strains of cannabis that would give you a different result. The point I'm making is the care that this facility had to deliver something truly good to the customer, not just to make money. They were trying to do good. the thing that was most relevant to me was I left the place around 9 a.m. They have to open the place to let all the customers in. I'm waiting for my crewmates to gear up so we can go to the next location. So I'm standing outside waiting for them. I notice the line of people waiting to come in. There's an elderly couple. There is a young student. There is a businessman checking his BlackBerry. I mean, this was America I was looking at. It wasn't a bunch of evil hippies. It wasn't a bunch of homeless kids with their dog on a rope. It was the elderly couple. It was the business guy. It was the student. It was a New York subway car. It was America. It was everybody. And that's when it really hit me. That's when I got it. And I went, wow, this needs to happen all over the United States of America, where the old couple, and who knows, it may be for the woman who has arthritis and she wants to knit again and the cannabis helps. Whatever it is, maybe the guy's got lower back pain. I don't know. I don't care. What I care about is these people being able to get to this product. And this is why I wanted to talk to you, because you are going to be doing it. And I hope that you make a lot of money. I want you to become very, very wealthy, but it has to be more than just making a lot of money. A great deal of care needs to be taken. Why? Because you are about to combat and overthrow and overturn centuries of oppression and discrimination in this country. And when you start legalizing cannabis and when you start selling it and interpreting the perception of cannabis in your home state, wherever you reside, a lot of you are Californians, I bet, but there's some of you from out of state, you are going to be diplomats. You're going to be ambassadors of a culture that has always been with us but has had to hide in the shadows. I was born and raised in Washington, D.C. I came to Los Angeles, California to join the band Black Flag in the summer of 1981. It was quite a sea change. I was brought up in a very politically correct, egalitarian punk rock scene. There's a girl who plays bass in a band. No one went, "That's a girl in a band." We said, "That's the bass player, and she likes tofu. Let's talk about endangered species." That's the kind of people we were. And so I come out to California, and things are a bit more feral and a bit different. Here's the thing I noticed in the summer of 1984, where Black Flag, we spent most of the year outside of the state because we feared police suppression because the cops did not like us and we didn't like them. That was, I think, Chief Daryl Gates was in charge in those days. He didn't like us, we didn't like them, and it was an awful thing. Also, the Olympics came to Los Angeles, and we knew they were going to clear the city of people like us, so we just booked lots of shows. Here's the thing I noticed around 1983, 1984 in Los Angeles. Maybe you being a Californian noticed it where you live. I noticed I would come back from tour, and there's no internet. There's no way to catch up on the gossip except to go hang out somewhere and ask, what's been going on since I came back from the last 9-year tour of Black Flag? And you found out that 3 of your friends now do heroin. 2 of your friends OD'd and died from heroin. That you can no longer get weed. Your cannabis dealer now deals heroin. And he'll give you 2 weeks free to see if you're interested. And these people would say to me, "Me and my girlfriend have been trying heroin for 6 weeks. Trying it for 6 weeks? Yeah. It's really cool. You want to try some?" No. "We're not addicted." "Oh, no, 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 you're not addicted." "No, after 6 weeks of trying it, no, not addicted at all, with the snot coming out of your nose, you're falling asleep in front of me." And there came a time in Los Angeles where, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but not too much, where you could walk down the street and almost trip over a duffel bag of heroin. You'd go to a Denny's, "I'd like an omelet. Would you like extra heroin with that?" It was everywhere. At that time, I had never heard of COINTELPRO. I did not know what that was. You remember that, Hoover? What I did understand is I read Howl by Allen Ginsberg, and I understood that wonderful turned-on minds in a generation will be driven into the street and made to go crazy by the powers that be. And I thought to myself, they are trying to kill us. Law enforcement is targeting punk rock people, young people. They want us to die. They want to turn this punk rock community into a self-cleaning oven. They want us to fix and die, or fix and get arrested. Either way, we fuel that drugs are bad, just say no. It was not a war on drugs. It was a war on young people. It was a war on black people. It was a war on brown people. It was a war on what they thought was counterculture that offended Ronald Reagan's lily-white conservative America. And that's when I became incredibly switched on to the politics of cannabis. Now, you are all entrepreneurs, I guess, which means you're going to be making money. When Alex said to you, you're going to make money, everyone went, "Wee! Good! You need to make some money." But here's the last thing I want to impart to you before we do the Q&A, and I'll get out of your way for the rest of the day. You're going to be selling stuff, and some of you might be cold-blooded capitalists, where you just sell stuff and make money. That is how the major label industry died. I spent 10 weird years being on two major labels. And the new A&R guy would come into DreamWorks, the label I was on. And he would be my A&R guy, my representative at a massive Death Star corporate entity. So I need him to be analog cool. And this guy said to me, "I used to sell computer parts. Now I'm selling records." And I went, "Oh, I'm screwed." And luckily, I had one more record on my contract. I did it. And they said, "Get out." And I said, "I'm going." And so that might describe one or two of you, where you like to sell stuff and make money. I cannot tell you this as too many times. You are not just selling stuff. You are selling the great change of a long-held idea in this country that you can oppress people because of their economic strata or their skin color or who they love. Cannabis plays into that. Now, as Alex said, the cops will have less people to bust. They won't know what to do with themselves for a while, so they might start making stuff up. It's a problem. And so there will be a problem with states who don't like you anyway, but they need your money. And so you need to be very careful with the people who will be coming to you to buy your goods. So if you are going to be a mere capitalist and just take people's money, I have an unconditional affection for you because you're sitting through this, but you're here. Screw you. If you're just going to sell stuff and make money and not give a damn about these people. Okay? And so I'm not trying to be tree-huggy or too utopian. Actually, I am, because I think I'm right. This is the start of something really big. And I think you and we are all at the ground floor of what is going to start as a revolution and is going to end as a, what were we thinking? History will look back, like 100 years from now, they'll be teaching this in university, saying, a long time ago, there was a weird kind of prohibition in America steeped in racism and bigotry and ignorance against the use of cannabis, and now they make the shells of spaceships out of hemp. Why, there's hemp in my toothpaste. There's my son's hair is made of hemp. And there's everything will be made of hemp, and there'll be cannabis anywhere you want it. This is the beginning of that. And so you are, in a way, revolutionaries. But to me, you're brainy and you're gutsy because you are taking on something and you're getting in on the ground floor of something that is going to be, 50 years from now, for rote. But for now, it's dicey. And so you are going to have to defang and declaw the idea of cannabis. To the right of my father is a wall and Sean Hannity. I don't know if this homophobic, racist, misogynist PhD is still alive. The last time I saw him, I was a teenager, because I don't hang out with racist, homophobe, misogynists, as far as I know. I want my father, who thinks if you inhale weed, you become homosexual and the empire falls over. That's what he thinks. If you inhale one double lungful of cannabis, you go gay and the empire folds. And he once told me at age 7, "You know how Rome fell?" I was like, "I'm in second grade. I don't know what Rome is." Queers. Thanks, Dad. Thanks for the beginning of the ruining of my life. Oh, Ramones, please hurry up and make a record to save me. I would like cannabis dealers to be able to render this product to the public and change minds, where even my dad, who can't be convinced of anything smart or good, like global climate change, that you could convince him that maybe cannabis would be good for the pain in his lower back or his aching knees. To see, like, my dad with a hash brownie, that's the coup. To take someone who said no, 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 and no, and get them off opioids, get them off big pharma, and get them onto something grown from the ground with care. And that's it. And so, as Alex so eloquently said, this has to come from community, and it has to come from love, and it has to come from not only affection for what you're doing, but affection for the people that you are selling it to. Trust me, the money is going to come. You are basically starting to sell toothpaste. If people have teeth, they're going to use it. You are going to sell cannabis for the rest of your lives. It's probably going to go really, really well. But go to it with a kind heart, because there's some people who enjoy it for recreational purposes. Great, but there's going to be a lot of people, an overwhelming amount of people, who are going to buy it so they can stand up straight in the morning, so they can have an appetite because they're going through chemo or whatever it is. And as you know, cannabis has a million and one uses. We need to be part of the million, not the one use where you sit home, buy pizza, and watch the Sci-Fi Channel, because that is the perception. And cannabis is so much more. And who's telling you this? Someone who doesn't even use it. And so, but I see the overwhelming good in it. We are going to have to convince a country that voted Donald Trump into office that we are right and they need to read more. And that is our obligation. And I just hope that you never lose that idea. And to me, that's what makes all of this quite fun, because you can go to your job every day and make a ton of money. Great, great, do that. But know that you're doing something good, and if you approach it with good intent, good will come. If you approach it like you just want to make money, your product will taste like it, it'll look like it, your store will look like it. If you just like look like you're making money, it won't be nice, and everyone will know. And so please, go at it with a good heart. And that is basically what I wanted to say to you today. And so, Alex, if you're here, you want to break in. I don't know if anyone would have any questions for the likes of me, because I'm not an entrepreneur. I'm just one of these people who's, I am rooting for you from the sidelines with everything I got, because I think that you are the future. And in one day, cannabis will just be common sense. Like aspirin, like a workout, like stretching before you go for a run. It'll just be that thing that we do. For now, that is the thing to wrestle, tame, organize. And I hope you leave here, whenever this thing is over, with that in mind and go forth into your entrepreneurial profit-based operations. And I own a few different companies. I write books, and since no one else will publish them, I do. I've had a number of record companies. I put out the records that I like. Some of them sell, some of them don't, but damn it, we got that avant jazz record into the world. Why? Because I really love what that piano player does. And I put out every record and every book I've ever done with a great deal of affection. And if I was the richest guy in the world, I would give it all away and just pay the artists their royalties, just whatever I owed them. But I always go after every if I'm on stage, I'm coming at the audience with affection. Anything I sell, I'm selling with affection. I don't mind making money, but I don't want to be a jerk about it, because that's the worst. And you never get it back. If you go into it with bad intent, it's hard to turn that around. And so I'm not going to sit here and repeat and repeat and repeat. You've heard me. I hope it was not too boring. If I had my way, I'd talk in front of you all day. Because as Alex said, I do travel a lot. I've been to about 100 countries in all 7 continents. And the one thing I've noticed all over the world, if you get humans in an environment where they're not terrified, they usually skew towards generosity and kindness and decency. And that's what I would like to think that this community is all about going forward. Thank you. Have a really nice day.
Henry Rollins. That was great. I gotta say, he's probably the first keynote speaker we've ever had who worked up a sweat on stage. That's pretty impressive. Do you have questions? We have time for a few questions. There's a question right here. We'll come over here. There you go.
Mr. Owens, Shenandoah Childers from the Central Valley, big agriculture area out here. I came from Silver Spring, Maryland as well. The question is, I guess, what do you see as far as it appears to be an inevitable industrialization of everything in America, the food supply, the medicine. How long until that occurs in your mind's eye? And what can we do on this level to really keep that from occurring?
That's a great question, and I'm sorry I didn't bring it up today. Thank you for doing it, because I've been thinking about that a lot. Anything with this amount of cash potential, the Walmart-sized U.S. Steel forces, no doubt, are like standing there going, licking their chops, waiting to jump in. I would like to think that you all would do such a great job with even the art on the packaging and the sincerity with which you vend, that if Marlboro came in and tried to make Walmart cannabis in that awful hard pack and sell it in a 7-Eleven, I would like to think that cannabis fans would reject it out of hand and rather go to the mom and pop place and reject the big box store version of cannabis. Because eventually you'll be able to buy something, a cannabis product, from Amazon delivered by an Amazon drone. I would like to see the local level be like the mom and pop bookstores and record stores that I used to go into in the 80s and enjoy. Sadly, many of them are gone because Barnes & Noble and all the big box stores, people who don't even read, are stocking books on shelves. They don't love books. They just love product and selling it. And so I think the important thing is what I was saying, and no doubt what you're thinking, is that we really have to keep this, the integrity over the quality over quantity. Because no doubt someone's going to come in and change their fields from corn, potatoes, tobacco or whatever, and try and get in on this. I'm hoping that the fans, the consumers of cannabis, will be able to separate the corporate greed monsters from the people who are truly inspired. And that's up to them being smart, but it's up to you delivering the right message from just how you sell it, how it looks, and how you translate the use of cannabis to the people in your community. I say it starts local, because no doubt the big money is going to come in. How can they resist? They've got the capacity. They can just do startups. Like the three brothers I met in Colorado. I said, so, how much money do you make in this place? They're not going to tell me anything. Someone else said, they make six figures a week out of this building. I said, what's the next step? They said, we have a building 10 times this size that we're building out now, and we're using clones of our plants to put in there. I go, then what's the next step after that? We're going to take this into different states. I said, then what's the next step after that? You'll be making the GDP of Spain every single week. Like, where do you go from there? And the guy just smiled and said, we go until the market just goes like, okay, that's enough. And so these guys were kind of scorched earth. They were just like, how much money can we make? And that's okay, as long as the product is good and the rendering of it is good. It was a little scary to me that they were so after the money. And that's why I'm begging all of you, is just to remember you're selling a thing that came out of the ground or a tub of water. You're selling it to people who need it for all kinds of reasons. Be cool about it, and the money will come. That's what I think. I'm scared of the corporatization of anything. It damn near killed music. Sure. And I don't want it to kill this industry. Because if it does, then the bad guys have finally won. They've won on the ultimate level. They used to be able to throw you in jail, and now they can sell it to you? That would be the biggest possible loss. And I think this is one of the only times where the people can win. There it is. So, and I'm sorry,
all right.
When I get asked questions, I'll go on for days.
Do your thing. I think a good parallel would be if you think of craft beer and microbreweries, right?
Like, that's exactly what I was
saying. Who do you know
say?
Who buys Budweiser? We all drink fancy-ass beers out here and go to the local brewery. And you have to keep that in mind as you build your small mom-and-pop grow. Have a niche. Have a backstory. Have a thing. Have a marketing plan. Don't worry about competing with those big guys, but don't be afraid of them either.
Right. Hey, Andrew, we got an 05 mil Sapphire coffee creamer you could drop in your coffee every morning. I think it put a nice trim on your program there.
What a cannabis added into my coffee? Isn't that having like an arm wrestling match with your body? Go fast, go slow, go fast, go slow.
So what do we do with this localized and your localized approach when we have these local communities that are putting their own spin on the law now. And you know, some are accepting, some are rejecting, and it's not. It's like the whole state is like in a state of...
Wait, were you saying some communities are rejecting cannabis?
Oh, yeah, big
okay,
time.
Okay, well, there we go with our charm offensive, I think, where you remove their prejudice and their fear. And I was thinking, what if you had, like, Free Sample Sunday, where you bring in people like my dad, who's just against everything good, and go, like, look, like, what ails you? Well, I have chronic headaches. Hey, you know what? Take a pinch of this and check it out. Free! And if you dig it, come back for more. You're a pusher. No. I'm trying to get you off Oxycontin or whatever and get you on something that comes out of the damn ground. And so I think it is, and this is what I said to all of you, it is going to be how you translate the good of cannabis to your community that's going to turn those people around. And it might be a hard, we adults, we are steeped in our hubris. We don't like our minds changed. But if you do it just right, once you change them, you change them for good. Also, I also think that some of the resistance to cannabis is somewhat generational, in that young people, they're already in. People my age and older, you might have to pull us ever so gently into the light. But I think in the next 10 years, I think the resistance will be a fraction of what it is now. But like I said, it's up to how you pitch it is to be how they're going to catch it. So.
Morning, Henry.
Hey.
Great talk. Thank you.
Nice.
My name is Steve Gutman. I'm a native San Franciscan. Industrialization is on everybody's mind. I mean, that was exactly the question I wanted to ask. And you talked about some great things, but didn't you leave out one big thing that we could do, which is, you know, I know the word corporate may not apply yet to everybody here, but we are corporate citizens. We're business people. Good corporate citizenship is part of the way to win the hearts and minds of our local communities.
Absolutely.
Build parks. You know, donate, be in your community, make it so attractive. You're going to be better corporate citizens than R.J. Reynolds and Amazon and, you know, all those industrialized.
Yeah, prove them wrong.
Prove them wrong.
I mean, that would be, that's such a tremendous
so I
idea.
To address that. That's
like the best idea this morning. I mean, truly. Like a park or a bridge or a school, it's unimpeachable. I mean, that would be a wonderful way to go because I think the money is going to be tremendous, and it would be so great if you were doing tremendously well in your township that you could turn that around and do something visibly good with it. Long time ago, a buddy of mine, his name is Michael Stipe, he's from some bar band called REM. We were driving through Athens, Georgia one night after a show of mine. He came to the show like in 1988, and we're driving in his 900-year-old car covered in dog fur, and we're driving around, and he went, I bought that building. I bought that one too. I go, okay, you're Michael Stipe, you own the world, you can buy buildings. Why? Because and some historical thing had happened in that building and they're going to tear it down. And then he put like a vegan restaurant in that building, so he owns it. And he said, guess what we're doing now? I said, what? It's like, me and my bandmates, we're buying parts of the rainforest. I'm forgetting in what country. And, you know, I'm a young idiot. I went, what are you going to do with it? He went, nothing. And I went, well, why do you buy property and do nothing? Oh, huh. Damn, Michael, that is really cool. But the thing, you know, he took his REM money, which is, you know, plenty, and he was keeping Athens, Georgia, his beloved city, intact. He was giving back. And I think if the cannabis industry can be leading in that, who could put you down? It'd be great to see a kid go to school in a school built on cannabis sales, and the arch-conservative guy, with great regret, lets this kid out of the Escalade go into that damn hippie facility and get a good education. Sons of bitches! So that's the best idea this morning. Thank you, you fit. Thank you. Good morning.
Yo, give it up. Henry Rollins, everybody. Yo, make some noise. A living American legend right here in the house. We love you, Henry.